The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is my Cyber Show.
No, it's my Cyber Show.
No, it's mycybershow.co.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
When I started to try to sell my corporate comedian services, one of the first things I said is, well, we're going to make jokes and talk about management in a humorous fashion. The response we got was a pushback because they said, hey, we already know our management's a joke.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Fred here. December 13th is our All.NET Community Summit. We will be discussing all things cybersecurity. If you would like to attend live, online, remote, sign up to the mailing list at All.NET. That's ALL.NET.
For details on anything you hear about at the Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Today's pitch is from Alira Pharmaceuticals. They develop drugs to cure rare diseases.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Alira was founded in 2020, and we're focused on developing drugs to treat diseases such as cancer, autoimmune disease, and pediatric rare diseases. Our lead program blocks the interactions of proteins that activate a protein called PAC1, which is very prevalent among solid tumors and plays a role in multiple cancers and rare diseases. ALY-101 has shown tumor-killing activity in multiple cancer types in vivo and in vitro as well, especially in a mouse melanoma model. We've shown that it can kill tumors across multiple cancer types. How did we develop ALY-101? Well, ALY-101 was first discovered using sophisticated in silico modeling software at the Italian Institute of Technology in Genoa, Italy. Basically, what happens is we have computational structures of PAC1 and other molecules we want to inhibit. We look at artificial synthetic structures of molecules that we can bind to separate pockets in those proteins, and then we run simulations to see if we can block interactions or how tight we can make those interactions with those drugs. We generate workflows that we can then use machine learning to optimize in terms of structural biology. Then we move on to cell-based assays that can screen those compounds after we make them for real that were made in a computer. And then we move on to what are called tumor organoid assays. Assays where we grow tumors in a dish with their own blood supplies to simulate what happens in the body. After we show activity in those assays, we move on to mouse models where we use tumors actually from specific cancer patients to test whether or not the drug can work against those tumors. PAC1 is also directly involved in the pathology of rare diseases such as neurofibromatosis type 2 and Ewing sarcoma, both of which strike adolescents. Alira has ongoing collaborations with translational researchers at the Baylor College of Medicine and Indiana University to evaluate the potential of ALY-101 in the treatment of these diseases. Our approach is to not necessarily directly inhibit PAC1, but to inhibit an activator of PAC1 so that we can more precisely attack this enzyme and prevent its effects from driving tumorigenesis, metastasis, and tumor blood vessel formation. Our focus is really on developing products that are very precisely inhibiting those activators, and we have been successful in developing drugs at doses that are suitable for human consumption. Our focus these days is on developing an oral formulation of this drug, and we just recently achieved that. We have issued patents in the U.S. and Europe and additional compounds in the same family. Overall, about 90% of solid tumors overexpress PAC1 and 12% of blood tumors like leukemias and lymphomas. Over the next 2 years, our focus is on continuing to advance developing that oral formulation, working with it in mouse models of different cancers. We recently won a $200,000 safe note from Berkeley SkyDeck, a fund focused on translational research. We have rare disease collaborations in neurofibromatosis at Indiana University and at Baylor College of Medicine in Ewing sarcoma. As I mentioned, we have issued European and U.S. patents and recently had two publications in key medical journals. We have advisors from SkyDeck from companies such as Genentech and Exelixis, and our goal in the next year is to prepare for going into the clinic in 2024, continuing in vivo studies in different indications and looking at drug combinations to explore the sensitization and expand our rare disease work.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. He's just pulling double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their gee whiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news from the Cyber Show. Computer crime is up, apparently because awareness of it is down. A new series detailing cybercrime and how to defend against it is on the air. In fact, it's on this show. Stay tuned for details on how they are ripping you off later in this hour.
Now on to our first presenting company. Steve from Air Services, welcome back. When we were talking last, we were talking about the explosion of the internet after you had created one of the earliest MLS, I guess the first internet MLS, right? Multi-listing. Yeah.
There was one other company up in Canada that we found that was doing something similar, but they faded out fast.
So were you doing this everywhere in the country or just in your
local country? Well, what had happened is we started with our local region, and then we went to the National Association of Realtors Convention, and, you know, it took off from there. I came home with, you know, a box full of cards. I had the Alexandria MLS. I had the Russian MLS card. I had just...
Wait, hang on. You were doing the MLS for Russia?
It was crazy. No, these guys were coming to my booth, you know, saying, look, we want to use your technology. We're very interested in what you're doing.
So you were going to license it or what?
Well, we didn't... We were just swamped. I came home and I had a whole map full of pins and contacts I had to make, and I just was picking them off these different associations. And so we started working with the Miami regional MLS, it was Greater Miami, and we took the data from them again as a parallel product. They weren't going to let us use it as a primary because we were new. We were the internet. And the same thing happened with the Southern California group, the MR. The multiple regional MLS down there, we were getting data from them.
Yeah. But so what was this? Was this like dial in?
Yeah. We were using 28.8, and you know, we were building
right, so 28 kilobaud modems. We were to dial in and get the information and then populate it on the internet.
Unbelievable. We were using Netscape and Microsoft Internet Explorer. So we had to build two at the same time, you know, if this, then that, you know, so it was really we were young and we were learning. So away we went.
Okay. Now, Steve, we know you were never young, so let's not go that route. So this, it has an explosive potential for growth. So did you grow explosively?
Well, we did. We were starting to get calls all over the country to go. We did some of the primary MLSs for some of these little groups.
Well, but so what happened? So did you exit and become a billionaire?
No, what had happened is we ran into a fellow who was the Century 21 franchiser for Venezuela. And he also had all of the Coldwell Banker franchise for South America. And so we thought, well, this is great because the internet will work really well because our landlines are lousy and so forth. And we could really bring this whole business together in South America. The reason we got leading that direction was the decision process through the U.S. organizations, these associations, takes forever. You know, nobody wants to make a decision and so forth. So we got the opportunity to start working with this fellow down there. And so we started building the Venezuela version. At the same time, we did a request for proposal for the Toronto Real Estate Board. And gosh, there was 51 entries and big corporations. And we actually worked our way down and they selected us to build their primary MLS system. I mean, gosh, we were up against GE Capital and Inter Realty, More Data and so forth.
All right. But so you still haven't told me what happened. So do you exit with a...
Hang on. It's right there. So what had happened is during their due diligence, the Canadians decided to build it themselves with all the information we gave them. And then the next thing that happened is there was a revolution in Venezuela. So our guys had to run offshore if you don't, you know, know your history. And then as we were licking our wounds, we came back and we're saying, well, fellas, we burned out the last 6 months worth of work on this. 9/11 hit. And as we were looking for capital, everybody dried up and we said, well, never mind, let's close this thing down. So we closed it down right as we were kind of exploring, you know, getting into the market. But, you know, we didn't have good business sense at that point either. You know, we had great technology, but we were young and dumb and we just didn't make it. So, you know what?
All right. So let's talk about what happened next. Next show, you can join us, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So the classic, right?
Right.
Opportunity,
best technology out there, start to sell it, get lots of leads, explosive growth, and then,
That's right. Early starters aren't always the big finishers. And he also touched on the, you know, something, you know, I've thought about and worked on a lot, you know, over the years is small countries versus big, you know, pros and cons of everything. You know, you work a little startup, you work at a big global multinational, pros and cons, you know, in the US and the EU, the developed world, as it's called, a lot of legislation, you know, it's not the Wild West anymore. A lot of gentrification going on, a lot of, you know, hoops to jump through. And I agree. Sometimes the risk is huge. You always got to walk in. It's 10 years right now since I went to Yemen, you know, trying to get a cert established there, and things have not improved, right? But there is learning opportunities, not always good for the individual entrepreneur, but for the rest of us, you know, looking how different entities, different countries do things.
Yeah, there was also the corporate go slow and the RFP where you give them all the information they request and then they just do it themselves.
Yep. Oh yeah, a lot of cliches.
All of the classics, right?
So, all the classics.
So presumably, and he said, you know, he's naive about it, right? So he didn't have a contract, a non-disclosure agreement, or a non-compete, or something before he revealed the information, and it's sort of a disingenuous RFP to go through that process, obviously. But just, you know, lessons learned. This is one of the things that I think is thematic in why getting advice from somebody and following it from somebody who's been there before is so important, because you can't reasonably know all the different bad things that can happen along the way. And probably if you're a really early stage company, you can't afford a lawyer, you know, who has all that experience to spend all the time it takes to tell you about everything.
Your competitors can, yes.
That's right. So, you know, this is just one of those things where you have to learn it. And we're going to see, you know, obviously more, because, you know, we're currently 20 some years ago at this point in the conversation.
Well, I think the lesson to take from this might be that, you know, everybody has a great idea. And I think most people, most early entrepreneurs and, you know, creative folks understand at the beginning, before anybody uses their thing or they have any business at all, that it's probably not going to work because life's complicated. But there's this little plateau where it starts to work, you know, and you're filled with adrenaline, you know, sometimes filled with a little bit of money and, you know, things are actually working. That's a warning sign. That's when you should stop and go, oh, there be sharks in the water. You know, I was right. You know, this is going to work. You know, will it work for me? That's a great, yeah, that feeling of euphoria when you're starting to get your success and things are settling in is a really good red flag that you need to stop and get really serious and look at all those things you didn't have time for yet.
And get really good outside help if you haven't done this three times before. Just a part of this, there's this pattern, right? So you start out, you have a small number of people, it has to do with, you know, you can manage everybody because you know them all, but somewhere around, you know, 50 to 100 people, you cannot anymore. You can't spend the time with each of them to do that. So you create the hierarchy or whatever the structure is for your organization. And that goes along until you hit about, well, the end of what used to be small business was 250. We had a company that got to 250 people in the 1980s. You got from 8 to 250 in less than 6 months. So, you know, there's explosive growth. And at that threshold, you need another level of hierarchy. And then there's somewhere around $50 to $100 million. The company has to transition again. And then somewhere around $1 billion. It has to transition again. And then somewhere around $4 billion is sort of the last transition to the largest size. So getting through each of these transitions on your way up the ladder, depending on how far you go, is, of course, these are each critical points that you need to first recognize you're there. And hopefully on your path to being there, you'll have enough time and enough expertise around you to recognize that it's coming and plan for it, rather than hit the ceiling and then find out, oops.
Well, I was thinking, I've turned this around and put it on the advisors, right? You know, I think advisors today are underutilized. You know, the expertise is not leveraged well. You know, it's basically, you know, hey, Fred, you know, really respect and admire your resume. You know, can I use it in a press release and spam all your friends with a sales call? And advisors need to be able to do more than that. You need to recognize, you know, it's hard for founders, particularly at that first stage, to let go of that first level of control. And if you don't understand that, then it doesn't matter what other expertise you have.
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion surrounding advisors. And we've started to have this, and we'll probably have this over a long period of time. But I think you just characterize one set of advisors, and there are other sorts of advisors that come into play in different circumstances and different things that companies do to do that. So I think that's a subject for discussion over time.
And now a word from our sponsor. Our next A2E members forum is January 10th. Join the mailing list at a2e.co for details. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E, .co.
To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up. Well, now, on to our next company. Chris from Agatera, welcome back. How you doing, man?
Good to see you, Fred. How you been?
You started building boats a couple of years ago. and you built them on the water. That's right. So as opposed to building a boat on land and then putting it on the water, you built the boats on the water, right? And in the process, my understanding is, and this was during the pandemic, you lost a whole bunch of weight and now you're sort of in super good shape. You've also been doing a lot, right?
Yeah, it's been a lot of hands-on stuff, particularly the last year and a half. It's been about 18 months now since I've been, came back from Canada, got the wreckage of Mark Twain and what's now Sam Clemens, up and running. As you say, they've been built, two functional boats that have sailed 1,000 miles since, neither of which has ever touched shore effectively.
When you say that, you've been moving these things 1,000 miles of travel, I'm going to call it travel instead of sailing, and they're self-powered. That is, they get all the power from the environment that they're in.
Correct.
And so how long does it take to go 1,000 miles in one of these boats?
It's hard to say. I mean, the boats themselves have changed a lot along the way. We defined the minimum power characteristics, particularly from an electricity side. How many square feet do you have? How many solar panels can you expose to that? How much power can you store? How much can you put into the water? And I'm glad you use the term, because the energy envelope around the boats is really the point. Right now I'm in a narrow tidal area. So rather than moving at a certain time of day where I'm taking all the electricity that I took out of the sunlight and moving the boats against the current, I can wait until the current goes the opposite direction. And now I'm taking kilowatts of energy out of the water and putting it into the boats and
hang on now. You're taking kilowatts of energy out of the water. So as I understand it, at least at one point you had it, and maybe you still have a tidal motor. That is a motor that sits in the water. And as you lay at anchor, the water turns the turbine. And that generates a heck of a lot of energy, right? Water's an incompressible fluid. It's moving at whatever speed, and it'll just, rip the motor as fast as the motor will run, right?
All right. It's a good example of the power calculations and this sort of thing. So the energy in the environment around the boats is X. The contents of X are sunlight, wind, and tide. Primarily. So I can take any of this energy and I can convert it into other energy like electricity and store that with some losses along the way, and I can use it later. So with tidal energy, I do in fact have a 850-pound, 4-foot-long German tidal turbine on the deck of Mark Twain that can sit in the water and make 6,500 watts of electricity when the water is moving about 5 knots. So I can store that in batteries. I can use that later.
That's lunar power, right?
Lunar or solar power. Again, the sun and the moon, make the tides. There's two tidal cycles. It's the Earth's spinning around and the two bodies affecting the water on the surface. So there's a solar tide and a lunar tide every day.
So when we talk about this from an ecological standpoint, one of the important things I think to note is that when you're taking energy out and using it, turning it into heat or whatever, using it in another form, you're actually, if it's energy you're taking out from the lunar cycle, you're actually taking energy out of the moon and causing its orbit to decay slightly. And the question is, if we went to all tidal power, how soon would the moon crash into the Earth? Or is that something we shouldn't worry too much about?
That's something we shouldn't worry about. The water is taking the energy out of the moon, and it's going to do that if we're here or not. And it's going to move that energy around. It'll move sand grains in the bottom. It'll take that energy and put it into the environment around it. What we're doing is tapping into that stream. And we can tap into it by creating electricity with a turbine, as we're talking about, or by artfully, having our vessels in the place where the water is moving anyways, and then you're moving with zero loss in energy transfer.
Well, you say that, but you're taking tidal energy and turning it into electricity that would otherwise cause the motion of plants and other effects on animals. You're changing the temperature slightly and so forth. So there are side effects, and use of stuff produces side effects. Whether it's large or small, the effect on the world is a different issue. But in terms of doing the calculations, another one is wind, right? So when you take wind, a lot of the wind farms are killing birds. Taking the wind out of the sails of the trees presumably makes the trees not move as much, and maybe that affects how they grow. So everything you do has effects.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
Now, onto our first service provider, Ralph, who helps find funding faster. We were talking about, how you explain things to people and how those details start to impact how things work. I'm sort of wondering about how much of this stuff is regulated. And another thing that you've come up with and talked to me about over time is there are some regulatory schemes that you can take advantage of that give the business an advantage against the people who are trying to collect money against that they just otherwise couldn't have. And you've given examples. I don't want to name names of large retail chains that were basically messing up people that were providing product and not paying the full amount. Can you just talk about how they can have an advantage legally by going through a lending institution?
Well, it isn't always every lending institution. What you'll find is there is in factoring. Factoring is a business that basically fills a role just below banks. So there's regulations that protect factoring companies if they do the right things up front. There's terms called notification and verification. So once a factor has notification, they've let the debtor know that they're involved in the transaction, and that's typically just changing the remit to, sending a letter up front and then changing the remit to on an invoice. And then there's verification, which before the money is sent to the borrower, the debtor needs to be called and verified that the invoice is valid to be paid on X date and is X amount. And if everything is said affirmative, that's recorded. And then now you have notification and verification, which is a very powerful tool in financial transactions, in that that debtor who, if that invoice is lent against, the person who owes that money, the debtor on that invoice, really cannot walk away for any reason from that. They could declare bankruptcy or do the normal things, but they will always owe that money to the fact, because once notification and verification are in place, it is law that that has to be paid.
When you say it's law, when you talk about loans and these sorts of things, there's first position, second position. There are all these positions that different people have in the stack of who gets paid first. Can you explain what that is, how that works, and how you get in the middle of two other people that they owe money to?
Well, typically you won't be in the middle if you're smart. Nobody wants to ever be in the middle. What happens is, first position is the only position that counts. So when you go for a bank loan or a line of credit, any bank is going to put a use, file a, what's called a UCC-1 against your company. That gives them the right to your assets if anything goes wrong and they don't get paid back. So they get the assets of the business. So once another bank sees there's a UCC-1 filed, they won't lend to you. So it
keeps, right, so they checked with the regulatory agency to see this. Yes. So there's a common data set. Yes. So everybody files it. Once you see it filed, you're just not going to do it. And that's
No other banks will get involved with you without paying that off first and putting themselves in first position.
Oh, so they'll take over the loan if they decide to do it. They'll pay off the first institution.
They'll do that first if you can afford that plus what else you need. So that's the real.
Okay. So that goes for factors too. So if they have a loan and you're a factor, you can't get in first position unless you pay off the loan.
Right. You won't. It's not every loan you have to pay off, though. So in other words, there's some factors who, if they see an idle loan, banks right now, if they see your idle, the loans that were given out during COVID, they see that you have one, many banks will either have to get it subordinated or pay it off. Most people wouldn't want to pay it off because it doesn't make any sense. It's 3% money. So it really hurts their company to have to pay that off and then borrow at a higher rate against
them. So there's another big problem. That is, when you're going out for a loan, if you have other loans or other debts or other similar things, you could screw yourself up when you do it. So is there any way, for example, if they come to you, can you check these things out so that you don't interfere with what else is going on and somehow figure it out before you take the risk of notifying?
Oh, well, there's no risk to notify. It's where you're always going to look first before you do business with anyone anyway. So yes, you could tell if there's UCCs filed, and those are usually going to be washed out during the process of, we've talked, we've been retained to find a loan, we're reviewing a package, and now we're asking, well, it looks like you have a loan here or a loan there. Do you know anything about that? What's this? Do you have a UCC? And then we find it, and then we have to work through it. It's a matter of, if they're out there, and sometimes they're there because you borrowed money from someone and they just never removed the UCC. So you can get it removed yourself. So there's a little work that goes into it, but
so it might just remain lingering as something that isn't real, but it's
still real. Yeah, right. It's like some ghost. Sometimes you have ghost things on your credit report. It's just the same way. There can be a UCC that somebody, you know, you borrowed from 10 years ago, now they're out of business and no one ever bothered to drop it. You could take care of that, and we take care of that quickly. So
yeah, just credit reporting and that, these sorts of things. So sometimes you'll get credit reports. I know that I had a dispute with my cable provider over $100 when they refused to close my contract, even though it was the end of my contract, and decided to extract another month from me. And I was unhappy enough with them that I just refused to pay it for a while. And then eventually I just decided it was easier to pay it than to go through the trouble. But if they reported that to a credit agency, getting that removed or otherwise managed is problematic, right?
Yeah, but it's business credit isn't typically like that. I mean, most companies that you're dealing with don't report credit. at it. So
okay, so they may say they're going to, or they may send it to a collection agency, but they're not probably actually. They'll
probably report it if they send you to a collection agency, but nobody's. It's not like when you look on personal credit, and I could, you know, if I look at someone's personal credit, I could see how many times they paid their credit card late, you know, different things like that. It's not, businesses don't typically do that to other businesses. So
there you go. Interesting. All right, Ralph, thank you so much for answering all of our questions. So Chris, is this starting to sound like cyber world again?
It certainly is complicated, right?
Not just complicated. All this stuff with bad records, you know, stuff that didn't get deleted. People put things in that aren't true. The whole thing. And then they have to work through all this in these financial processes every time.
Well, and right, you know, and every chip has bad transistors from the factory and they go bad over time, but we still make it work well enough, right? You know, so we have trust built into our the hardware, into the software that manages the hardware, you know, all the way up to the, you know, it's turtles all the way down, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's just all the finance is all run through computers, of course. So these are all cyber systems and they have all the problems of all the other cyber systems. But to me, one of the things you see when you actually apply for a loan is the extent to which they do diligence. And this diligence requirement for financial stuff is completely different than the diligence that you'll see by a lot of investors, right? And the other thing is the investors don't necessarily have the right to do these things, right? So like looking up a credit report is something that if I do it as an investor, or I have private investigators that do this, when you want to do this, they'll look up your background, do the background checks. And they do this all online now, and it's very efficient, but that will count against your personal credit if you have people looking up your credit for potential loans. It reduces your credit rate. Whereas the banks don't have that problem. What they look up doesn't count in the same way, or something to that effect. So this whole system gives preference to financial institutions over other parties that are doing loans and investments and so forth. So I just think it's fascinating that leveraging of technology to make sure that the people with a lot of money get your money.
Well, you know, I've always loved, you know, operational technology and critical infrastructure from a security perspective because it's just so real, right? You know, the consequences of your website coming up and down and so forth are what they are. Those are real too. It's important. But, you know, your factory burning or your ship sinking and so forth really focuses the mind. And finance really is the same sort of thing. You know, there are trillions of dollars in digital money moving around all the time based on systems that are trustable enough that in fact do work. You know, that, you know, early in my career, arguing about the online banking and, you know, we'll never do online banking because it can't be secure enough to do XYZ.
Well, it was always online at that time too, right? Because it was always kept track of in computers. It wasn't pieces of paper.
Right. And as we all know, it turns out, you know, the systems are good enough, even with stupid passwords and, you know, all that other crap, that the financial institutions can say, oh, yeah, you know, we believe that wasn't you. Here's your money back.
So that one of the reasons is they're using transaction systems. That is to say, write only, append only mechanisms to assure that they have a good history. And I have systems of record that I run and they don't delete anything. I mean, you know, all they do is write the next version and now point you to the next version. And then the backup mechanisms do the same thing so that all the other things that can go wrong, you can't really modify something and have that modification, you know, if you're going to investigate it, go unnoticed.
Yeah. Archives and records management, as you know, right? You know, this is, if you want hope in the internet and in cybersecurity and so forth, you know, think about all the information it takes to be Fred Cohen and each of you out there, right? You know, there's all these records and so forth, and they're damn well good enough and have been, in fact, for thousands and thousands of years. You know, the cyber world has not developed quite that far yet, but the mechanisms are entirely possible.
Well, yeah, they're good enough for societies to prosper, but against individuals, people do get screwed. That's how it is, right?
That's right. And then again, that's why, you know, you and I are not going to age ourselves out of work as long as we feel like doing it. There's a lot of work to be done. You know, this is a great field to get into. Even if you're young, you'll have a job.
Guaranteed employment because things are going to keep breaking.
Right.
All right.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Our next Angel to Exit Members Forum is January 10th. Join the mailing list at a2e.co for details. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E, .co.
Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. This one's an example of what's called clickbait. It's designed to get you to click on something which is typically malicious and will then cause your system or your browser to do things that you don't want them to do to gain access to or otherwise create problems on your own system. There are a wide variety of similar sorts of scams out there. Here's an example of one that we got today. It was an email saying,
new voicemail attached from Alt.
And at this point, they have a phone number that's about 18 digits, but it's not a legitimate phone number anywhere in the world. And it says,
you have a new voicemail. Your voicemail is attached. To review the voicemail, open the attachment above.
But it's in an HTML, a file associated with a web interface, not an audio file or anything like that.
If you have any questions, please visit our support site.
And it's one of those things where I know if I open it, I'm going to get a Trojan horse or something like that. It's also codified as three levels of reply. It says,
regards, IT all team.
And it's, worst of all, sent from me to me. And being as I know I didn't send such a thing, I know that it's not possible in my infrastructure to get it. So this is just a sort of low quality fake email to try to get me to click on something intended to do harm to my system. Every week we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET and you press on books.
The Cyber Show is brought to you by Feet, the nanoseconds of light.
Now, on to our next service provider. Hank, welcome back. How you doing?
Very well, Fred. Good to talk to you again.
The promotion we have for you is that you're a lawyer, not a liar, so you're going to tell us the truth. And look, my experience with lawyers is most of them, at least the ones I've worked with, are not lying. They're telling the truth. They are certainly representing their client's interests, but they're not. You're not really allowed to just lie as a lawyer, right?
Oh, boy. That's a loaded question, my friend. That's a very loaded question. You are not allowed to lie. But I mean, it's, you know, and this is sort of this is just kind of my unvarnished view of things, having litigated a fair number of cases and also worked for, as a clerk at a busy court for a year. Folks, one's not allowed to lie. One cannot knowingly use, for example, perjured testimony, that you know to be false as evidence. I can't submit that to a court as evidence. But I think, you know, lawyers often go to great lengths to sort of create plausible deniability for themselves and their clients, such that stories that they, if they don't know, they certainly should know, are untrue, or facts that they certainly should know are inaccurate with any amount of diligence. You know, those are things I think that lawyers fairly frequently will use in an attempt to see how far they can push things.
Brought up a term there that's an interesting one, that's diligence. And many people, you know, don't understand that lawyers have some requirement to be diligent in making statements on behalf of their client. Can you tell us about what the diligence standard, if there is one?
Well, it's the diligence standard really is applicable in litigation. And there, as a general matter in federal court and in most state systems now, there are rules. And the notion is that the lawyer will conduct reasonable diligence before making assertions of fact or, you know, ultimate claims sort of law and fact as to what the obligations of other parties or the rights of their clients are. But the amount of diligence that would be considered reasonable, I think, you know, what's reasonable, that's open to debate. And I think one also will find that there are certain types of cases, certain types of parties who are given a lot more leeway than others. And typically when you see someone hammered for a, you know, in federal court, we would say a Rule 11 violation, that's filing a paper that makes frivolous arguments or that you should know contains false statements. Those typically people get punished for the Rule 11 violation in a context in which they were probably doing some other things wrong as well. So enforcement is certainly shy of what would be ideal to keep folks honest.
So this is the typical, very pleasant way of saying they just get away with all sorts of crap, right?
In a way. I mean, I often say to clients, brand new clients in the first interaction, you know, please don't take this personally, but, I'm going to presume that you're not telling me the truth here when I ask you some introductory questions.
So when you say not telling me the truth, you mean intentionally lying, or is it a matter of, well, you know, look, I'm doing the best I can, but I don't really necessarily understand your question perfectly.
Oh, it's a bunch of things. One, I mean, lawyers tend to ask questions that may not make sense to clients, either because they're poorly stated or seem to be out of context. That's one issue. A second issue, memory is inherently fallible. A third issue, which is probably the biggest one when it comes to dealing with your own clients. As I once heard it explained, you know, we tell ourselves a story as we go through the world. and we're the protagonist. You know, those who are with us are, you know, sort of positively cast characters, and anyone who's against us is an antagonist. And we tend to remember events that are consistent with that story. And the more we recount our story, the more certain we become of it, and the more facts we start to, in quotes, remember that support it. So I think by the time someone ends up in a dispute talking to a lawyer, they've probably told their story a number of times, and they may well believe everything that they're saying is factually true. But when you start to diligence that story, you know, there are certain aspects that they remember more positively than you find out is borne out by fact. And then I think that infects all of us when we're telling our story. And as a lawyer, I think you're wise to presume that is happening.
So we should talk about this a lot more. We need to talk about evidence, among other things.
You know, we see this playing out on the geopolitical stage at the moment, right? You know, down in Brazil, the former president contesting the election, and as I understand it, the federal court down there is, you know, thrown it out on frivolity and you know, levied a hefty fine. You know, I find myself, you know, several dozen episodes into a podcast for my main employer, you know, that's doing software supply chain security, but talking about transparency. You know, we went through a marketing exercise a year ago and came out with the tagline, software made certain. Certainty, right? And so much of, you know, in court, and in the court of public opinion, you know, so much of the world we live in is not positively influenced by lack of certainty. And I think a lot of these...
Hang on. It's not positively influenced by a lack of certainty.
Yes.
So, Chris, let's talk about being direct. What the heck do you mean?
Well, you know, as our guest is saying, right, you know, in court, you know, where you have a bounded topic, a bounded time, bounded audience, you know, the art of manipulating the meaning of the word true, right? You know, without ever saying anything falsely, but, you know, creating impressions, you know, that themselves are false, right? Is, you know, I'm no legal expert, but I think that's, you know, in as challenged a state as it ever has been right now for all the common reasons that deal out on the public state. How do you take reasonable people, you know, and allow them to be reasonably enabled to discern truth from bull poop? You got to be able to say that word.
So you can use the expression BS.
Okay, good.
Because we can't discuss, obviously, politics or religion, and you can't use the seven dirty words, but we'll get pretty close to them at times, as you will hear in this episode when we play it. I find it fascinating. I've worked with Hank for many years on a wide variety of cases. I've done expert witness work for him, and he's worked as an attorney for me, and as a consigliere is not the right word, but you know, basically he's one of my advisors for my company, and I'm one of his advisors for some of his legal things. And I find that I have all these misimpressions about some of the things in the law, and he recognizes, I think, really clearly the limitations of the law and the limitations of lawyers and the limitations of these processes, because he's in them all the time. And he talks about it in an honest way. Having said that, you know, he's sort of nice about saying things, right? So in essence, he says that certainly lawyers get as close to lying as you can get without going over the line. And then some of them go over the line. At the same time, I talked to him about other things, and you'll hear in some of our subsequent discussions about this. He just seems to have an ability to clarify things in a way that I can understand them, but they're still not definitive. And that's the nature of them. They're not definitive.
Well, clarify is the key word, right? And this is, again, where I see, you know, irresistible evolutionary pressures, right? And it's hard to believe in anything, you know, a system of governance, of law and so forth, when you can't see it. And the various actors, you know, using misinformation can influence those underlying concerns and amplify them and cause, you know, other larger scale problems. And all of that is reason enough for people to try to find a way around it. And as I've found, you know, as a relatively rebel young guy who spent a lot of time working with lawyers and legislators and so forth, and you find out that the vast majority of the time in a functioning democracy, that, you know, that rule right there that's a pain in the bottom right now is there because somebody put it in for a good reason, or they meant well. It just wasn't well thought out enough.
Part of the thing that I think prevents law from ever achieving this, you know, sort of automated, cyberized thing is that it's intended to be flexible to where it uses judgment at the time, and to where, as social mores change, then the law works differently. And it's intentionally vague, and it's intended to be that way. If you're seeking justice, you can't pre-account for every possibility. The whole concept of a jury is that the jury just can say, you know, I understand all that stuff, but no, I'm not willing to brutalize this person in that manner for what they did. I think it was justified.
But that's why I think what I think is the coming transparency in the cyber world helps with that, because you need a population that's not expecting computers to give them ones and zeros. You know, an entire population. And we certainly have it nationally, and I think globally right now, understanding that it's not that black and white. Before you start saying, all right, you know, here. But I think you can give enough certainty in the visibility. So if I'm impacted by some law or whatnot, that I don't have to spend, you know, 72 hours, you know, that it probably takes to Google up, hunt down, find out each piece of legislation and affecting policy, just put them to bloody together, much less find out what's been going on with all of them over time.
There is the concept in the law of notice. That is, the law has to notify you that something is illegal in order for it to be illegal. But it's not that it's a personal notification that you've been trained on it. It's that it's made public and it's publicly available and you can get to it. And it's your responsibility to get to it as part of your civil duty, especially when you're working in a particular field, to be knowledgeable about your field. So if you're running a business, you need to know enough about business law so you don't, you know, falsely advertise. And, you know, you should be aware that when you send out emails, you know, to large numbers of people for commercial purposes that you haven't communicated with before, that you need the footing on that. Otherwise, you can get sued for hundreds of dollars per email. I tell this to people in startups who are sending out, you know, hundreds of thousands of emails like this, and they say, baloney, you have to do that.
That's the kind of thing where cybernetics, you know, writ large, should tie all that stuff together for us. So whoever I am, I can just look at it and see, right?
Yeah, you should be able to be informed you're entering a jurisdiction where you can't smoke or whatever, right?
Yeah, I can find the information. As you say, it's published. It's public out there, but practically and logistically, I can't.
So this is interesting because interstate commerce is ruled by the federal government and there are standards for interstate commerce. And yet cannabis is legal here and not legal there, for example. And when you go to Russia, obviously, with a small amount of barely any cannabis, you can end up in jail for 15 or 25 years in hard labor. And so this issue of notice and automating notice, that's something that cyber can help with stupendously. The other thing, though, is as you drive across the country, you go through lots and lots of jurisdictions. And whereas state by state, you can sort of be aware of it. When you're on the interstate highways and the state police are monitoring it, then it's sort of a different world than if you drive through small town and try and go eat at their diner. And you've experienced some of that in your life.
Well, and you can see this already because, you know, your Google Maps on your Android phone and you're driving along the, you know, the highway or the road or whatnot, it'll match. It'll show you the speed limit where you are right there. And driving down to the Florida Keys is classic because it goes up and down all over the place for different reasons. And even if you know that, you blink, you miss it, you get a ticket. You know, that. So we're all already used to, everybody is used to seeing that on our phone. So automating that level of local jurisdiction in is already happening on a large scale.
Yeah, so I think that's actually a fascinating place to go. And that's, you know, we have this CalSciCom that I think you've heard us discuss with Perry. We're trying to identify the cyber-related regulations so that business people can determine whether or not they're breaking the rules. Yeah, that sort of information, I think you're right. There is ultimately, if we're going to continue having travel and commerce at that scale, necessity that we generate something of that sort.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Tuesday, December 13th, we have our all.net cybersecurity community meeting starting at 9 a.m. To sign up, join the mailing list at all.net. That's all.net.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.
Well, now, on to our next company. Sean from PowerGrow, welcome.
Thanks, Fred. Appreciate it.
Before we start talking about PowerGrow, I'd like to start talking about what you did for a living before you started PowerGrow. What were you doing before, and how long were you doing it for? How did you start out?
I was born on a farm in South Dakota, but my dad moved us to Denver when I was a kid. Never thought I'd be back in the ag tech space, but spent 15 years in the IT sector, primarily custom software development on the Microsoft platform for companies like Intel and Honeywell and American Express. And then I felt like I wasn't making much of a difference in the world. So I went to work for Siemens in their Energy and Environmental Solutions group, where we developed smart grid applications, waste energy plants, large solar arrays for public sector customers.
So give me a sense, what were you doing there? Were you an operational technology guy or?
More business development. That's been my background, really sales and marketing throughout my career. I'm just dangerous enough from a technical standpoint to be dangerous to myself and those around me. But we had really good engineers that we worked with throughout my career.
All right. So when it comes to things that actually physically move, you don't program them, right?
I do not.
Okay. So you're keeping us safe by not being involved in that part.
Exactly. Hand that off to the expert.
Excellent. So when did you come up with PowerGrow? How did that happen?
I met an engineer in Phoenix that worked for Ping Golf at the time. and he had patented a way to integrate a solar tracking system into the roof of a commercial greenhouse. We thought the technology was pretty novel, but as we learned more, we realized that for every 1 degree of shading in the greenhouse, you have about 0.5% loss in yield for the grower. What we really came to understand is that with what's going on with climate change and water drought issues in California and other states where most of the produce is grown, there's a real issue and a lot of inefficiencies in the food supply chain, especially produce growing. So we built PowerGrow to help farmers compete in the marketplace, but do so in a much more efficient manner in high-tech glass greenhouses. The only downside to a high-tech glass greenhouse is the energy intensity of the building. And we solved that by powering the facilities with solar and fuel cells. So we built a really innovative company that's helping change the way we can feed the world.
Before you rush into the ad for the company, let's talk about what you were talking about. So besides taking solar power, are you also then you have some sort of a digester or something, or how are you getting power besides solar?
With fuel cells from a company called Bloom Energy.
So what is a fuel cell? Describe how it works and how that makes you better.
Well, they're hydrogen fuel cells, so they can consume gas and turn that into hydrogen for the facility. What makes it unique for our environment is you want to inject CO2 into a greenhouse for the plants to grow anyway. And so we're able to capture the CO2 generated from the fuel cells, scrub it, and pump it back into the greenhouse to create truly a zero carbon, zero waste facility.
Okay, but more importantly, you want CO2, right?
Exactly. The greenhouses end up becoming a carbon sink.
It's literally a greenhouse gas. Yep. Because you're running the greenhouse.
That is exactly right. We're capturing greenhouse gases and turning it into healthy plants and throwing off oxygen.
Fantastic. Does the amount of CO2 in the location, does that make it so that human workers would have problems working in it?
No, it's extremely well controlled, and it's a nominal amount of CO2 that is just enough to help the plants grow and maximize their yield. But part of what makes our greenhouse unique is there are very few, if any, workers actually in the greenhouse. It's almost fully automated.
We'll get to that. But the point is, there's no danger in the fact that you're using all this CO2 and producing the CO2.
None at all.
And you're consuming everything you're producing by having it go into the plants to grow the plants, right?
Correct. That's exactly right.
Well, there you go, Chris. That's off to a rocket start.
Well, hold my solar-powered coffee, right? You can't get any more of my comfort zone than this conversation. It's, there's economics behind it. You could do this sort of thing, I suppose, anytime if you want to make a hobby of it. But there are times when things come together, where the cost of the material and technology and so forth allows us to cobble things together that are better, faster, cheaper than previously. And I am speaking to you all right now on a solar-powered boat, drinking solar-powered coffee, sailing around the Florida Intracoastal. So,
by the way, that solar-powered coffee, it's not just solar power and you heated it up and ground the coffee. It's also solar powered in that it was grown from solar power, because that's what grows plants, right?
Right. Of course, we can take this all the way, heating the air, moving the winds, and, made the plants and so forth, that made the oil that the ships use to move the coffee. The point is that there's lots of energy in our envelope. There's energy around us. We utilize or don't utilize it. To date, we have utilized energy with incredible inefficiency.
It's not just solar power. It's also They're using power that generates carbon, but they're consuming the carbon in the plants to make them grow better. So it's just all the better, right? This is what I call engineering, right?
Well, but again, it's like the boats, right? I sail these boats using solar power and electric motors and batteries and so forth, but also using the wind and tide, because that's the energy in my environment. The energy in the environment for these folks is, sun and gases and carbon and so forth, and they're tapping multiple sources. Just makes sense.
Yeah, well, they also, I believe, do digesters for the plants, so that when you grow a plant, there's a lot of waste besides the part that you eat. And that stuff then gets recycled into the ground and into generating energy as well. So if you do this really well, you can minimize it. But I don't think you can ever really get to zero. I mean, that is to say, we are consuming resources of the world and they are finite, but we're consuming them at a much lower rate than we otherwise would be.
Well, this is the common thread, of course. Resources, we're not actually consuming the atoms of the earth. They continue to exist to move around. We consume energy. And we recompile matter into various things. And there's a finite amount of matter on the face of the earth.
Well, but also when you consume that energy to do this, you're moving towards, the heat death of the universe, but not just that. You can't, these aren't all reversible processes, right? So when you burn something, you can't sort of unburn it and create a tree. You can plant another tree and try and grow that, but again, you're consuming along the way.
Well, yeah, we're wandering into philosophy here. You know, entropy is a thing, but, you know, and again, we ourselves are examples of, you know, organized systems of capturing energy and resources. To our guest point, now is the time where you can economically say, I'm taking these pieces of available technology and process and putting them together in this way, which is better, faster, cheaper. And if better is better for the environment and you care about that, and, you know, hopefully we all do, then that's a win. Yeah. But we can also do it with less cost, then everybody else will do it too, because less cost wins.
Now, onto our next service provider.
Ira, it's great to see you. How you doing?
Great. Nice seeing you as well. It's been way too long.
Well, just you, what you're saying is we're both getting old, but you know, this is radio, so they can't see that.
Well, I like to just think of it as you and I just haven't crossed paths on a more regular basis.
Fair enough. So you've been in the cybersecurity space for, I guess, your whole career, maybe your whole life. Is that basically right?
Yeah, pretty much. I would say when I graduated college, I started out at NSA, never really thinking I was doing cybersecurity. But, you know, according to the CISSP body of knowledge, apparently I was that whole time. So pretty much been doing it for give or take 38 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're still a young pup. Just you're giving up. So by now you must know at least 50% of it, right?
I don't know, even know if I know 5% of it, but you know, it's like the good part is I don't think most people know 1% of it. So it makes me look smart.
There you go. And so you started at the NSA. What, if you can tell us, don't tell us anything you're not allowed to, but tell us all about what it was like to go to work for the NSA. How did they recruit you? How did you end up, you know, getting in, and what did you do there? And then when did you leave?
So basically, when I was in college, I was a psychology major. So the odds of me getting a job were pretty negligible. So what happened was I ended up thinking, well, I want to go in the Foreign Service. So I went to the career office at Syracuse University where I, you know, where my got my undergraduate degree. And I was sitting there waiting for a meeting with the advisor. And then I saw this book that had a lot of puzzles on it. I just started doing the puzzles because I was bored. Anyway, I went in to speak to the guy. I'm like, well, I want to go into Foreign Service. He's like, well, you have to take a test. And, you know, maybe also, you know, there's a former ambassador that works for the university. You should go talk to him. And by the way, you know, there's also this other place that's recruiting, the National Security Agency. You might have never heard of them, but there's a book out there. And if you could kind of do a puzzle or two, maybe you want to like consider taking the test for it. And I said, this book? He's like, yeah. I go, I finished the book. He's like, okay, take the test. So anyway, took the test for it, did really, really well, apparently. Then
so wait, tell us about the test. What was on the test?
So they call it the Career Qualifications Battery, or CQB. And essentially what it had was, it had a lot of different, it wasn't like a blatant test that you would think of. But so for example, you had a math problem that was the equivalent of asterisk, asterisk, plus asterisk, asterisk over, you know, and then summarize asterisk, asterisk, question mark, asterisk, asterisk. And then it would be like, what's the question mark?
It could be an equal sign or who knows, right?
Well, no, it would be one because, you know, you have two-digit numbers, you add them together, and assuming they're a three-digit number, they obviously have to be between 199, well, technically 198 and 100. So you know the first digit's a one.
So 11 plus 11 is equal to 100 what?
Well, 11 plus 11 would be 22. So there would only be asterisk. There wouldn't be a question mark, asterisk, asterisk.
Oh, but the question mark could be a blank.
Well, no, not in this case. It had to be a number. At least that was the rules as I interpreted them. Right. And apparently I did well, so I got it right. But
So there might have been another answer. There was a much better answer that they didn't tell you about.
I don't know. But, you know, that was one question. There was another one where they kind of sort of made up a language, I think, and they would say, okay, if this is it, what would be the verb or something? I don't know. Then another one I remember, they had Chief 1 sends 5 messages by runner, 2 messages by boat, Chief 2 sends 0 messages by runner and 4 messages by boat, Chief 4, whatever, you know, boat, you know, runner and boat.
Yeah, how many boats do you need?
Yeah. And then, well, no, the question was, how many islands are there? who's the chief of the tribe, and so on. And so, you know, kind of, you know, I now looking back, it's probably a traffic analysis pattern, you know, problem type of thing. But anyway, you know, I remember thinking, God, this is, you know, I go, well, this is interesting. But then I remember going to the restroom during the break, and one guy was, who's the chief of the tribe? Jeez, what the hell are we doing here? And I kind of did well. But so anyway, you know, it was like questions like that. Apparently, it broke it down into, I think, 10 or, you know, like 8 or, you know, 8 to 10 different things. And I did, you know, apparently I got a 9, you know, it was a bell curve type of rating. I got a 9, 3/8, a 7, a few 6s, and maybe a couple 5s. And you had to get 3 5s or betters to, you know, make it to the next step. And given the fact I got a 9, few 8s, you know, I think.
Yeah, so you made it to the next step. And then what was the next step? Okay. So, you know, when I thought about it during the call, I was trying to get to the next question, the next one. But, he didn't tell us what was exactly on the paper. But I wonder if there's a minus sign, you know, like -9 plus -9 is equal to -18. And who even said that they were positive integers with no leading zero? So, you know, it could be that and he only got 9s and 5s, right? So maybe that was one of his 5s because he got the obvious answer of a grade school arithmetic answer. When, of course, if you were really sophisticated, you would realize that GTSX would respond with YSR, and so Y would be the answer. And so I think the test is revealing about how the NSA deal things. It's also revealing about his view of himself. But I just love it that, you know, this is how you end up getting into the National Security Agency.
You know, I love Ira so much, you know, and I have to, if I on any of these shows, you know, fail to say that when talking about one of our friends here, I mean it all the time, right? Because look at it, right? You know, I was this fascinating guy with this fascinating background, you know, that little bit, you know, how do you get into the NSA in those days? Just like that, right? Pattern matching, recognition, you know, so often we talk about this is the cyber show and it's human stuff. And there's nothing more analogous to what we're trying to do with cyber intelligence than human intelligence. And there's a certain amount of trust built into it and understanding how people's minds work.
Well, you know, human beings are cybernetic systems, right?
Well, you know, effectively, yes. But, you know, we're so deep into the emergent properties that this is why we have psychology.
No, but so the term cybernetics, you know, defined by Norbert Wiener, you know, way back in the 1940s in his book called Cybernetics, Sensors, Actuators, Communications, and Control. It was about control systems. And he was talking about human control systems and about electronic control systems and analog control systems, right? So it's not cybernetics is human. Humans are cybernetic organisms.
Well, I watched Good Night Opie last night, and my cat Teddy was born at the same time Opportunity landed on Mars and passed away the same day. They declared Opie a DOA. And the attachment, you know, they talk about it, is a wonderful piece if you haven't watched it. And the attachment everybody had with this robot. Why? I mean, because it kind of looks like a person-y thing. It's kind of got eyes and it wanders around, does things, goes through his life, right? You know, and to be clear, it's not intelligent. You know, it's an emergent property of a bunch of people doing things. But yeah, we are systems. We interact together in systems. So we build technical systems to overlay that and augment that and help us along with it. But, you know, anyway, we see this, you and I have seen this over and over in our careers. We lose sight and say, oh, the technology is really neat. It's like, yeah. Yes, it is. Nobody cares.
The other thing that I find interesting about this and every one of these stories is how did you get into this, right?
Right.
And there's this sort of notion that somehow you're destined, or when you're young, you say, when I was 3 years old, I knew I was going to be a rock star. Yeah, no. Right. It's like, well, I needed a job, man. And so I was just having to play with this game. And when I came in, they said, oh, if you're at that, I played with that game. I already won it. Oh, go.
You know, start doing it. Things will, and that's one of the things I love about our, you know, cyber tribe here is there is no way you can be about my age or older and have gotten here by a linear path. There was no place to take the lessons. There was no path. So it's an interesting time. You know, our generation of cybersecurity people will go on. It'll never happen again. Not in our space. It'll be other groups and cohorts that you know, come along in other emerging areas. But, you know, now you can go get a PhD in this stuff from scratch.
Yeah, well, I got a PhD in this stuff from scratch, but that's
PhDs too, but that's a different thing.
Well, but so the thing that's been a career decision for me was that I'm not going to do things that everybody else is already doing, right? I wanted to be a researcher and I was going to do something that nobody else had done. And as soon as it gets to the research that consists of incremental improvements, I'm walking away from it and going somewhere else. That's why I stopped doing the computer virus thing after I sort of finished everything about early 1990s. There was nothing else to do as far as I can tell. And still true, right? It's not that there aren't things to do. It's that it's not something that's completely different than what happened before. So I just moved on to the next thing. And I think that distinguishes most of the people that are in these highly evolutionary areas and keep changing from one thing to the next to the next. It's fun. It's interesting. It's always novel. And I love it. But I don't think cybersecurity today is that way. I think if you're going to come up in cybersecurity today, there's no chance you're going to take the path that we took.
No. There was a Matt DeVoe at OODA. You know, I hope Facebook lasts long enough for my purposes because I have a great community conversation going on with Ira and Matt and all sorts of people in our crowd. And he posted just the other day about hacking. And I went on a little bit of a rant. You know, hacking is not about breaking passwords. That's a parlor trick, right? Hacking is about looking and saying, it's like the Lego master builder. You look around your environment and say, huh, there's this piece and that piece and that piece. And if I put them together this way, I have this new thing. Isn't that fun? It's different than creating, right? It's looking around your environment and hacking it, you know, making it change. And again, our demographic, our generation of cybersecurity folks all got here because one way or another, through all these different divergent paths, it would be fascinating to study that. You know, what is it about the different paths? You know, what's the commonality between all of us? And I don't know if anybody's written a PhD on that, but I know it's out there to be written.
Well, I guess we're providing the raw data by having the show.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.